turn things over to Professor Pat Armstrong, who's going to introduce our speaker, and then we'll hear from Professor Vesey.
I am also on the executive of the Global Labor. And I was going to say I'm an old friend of Karen's, but that made me sound like I'm just old rather than, which part should I put the old on?
Well, we're both old, so that
that's
doesn't distinguish
true.
Us.
That's
Why don't
true.
We just
that's
say
true.
That we're friends?
I was thinking when
if we're still friends.
Well, yeah, we are still. Well, it depends on how I introduce you.
Yes, it does. It's totally conditional.
I was thinking about introducing Karen today. I was reminded of a conference I went to a number of years ago. It was a really large international conference on women and work. And Albert Banerjee and I were there. Albert was a student here at the time. And the first session we went to, every paper referenced Karen Vesey. And so then the second session.
Did I give it?
I don't even think they knew you. And then the next session, the same thing happened. So we decided to count to see if we could go to a session that didn't reference Karen Messing. And we were unsuccessful, even to the one that Albert went to that was all in Spanish. So I think it's just a tiny indicator of Karen's international reputation, especially among the international group that does women in work, and in multiple languages, in French and Spanish and in English. And Karen's a hard scientist, but she has a soft spot for other kinds of ways of seeing, sort of. And what she's going to talk about today, as I understand it, is one really important demonstration of that, her involvement in the founding of Symbios, which she is going to tell you more about, I am sure, which is an extraordinary research center in Quebec, a research center that was doing what academics now call knowledge mobilization and knowledge transfer long before the terms were invented, and we're doing it in a much more meaningful way in terms of reflecting what the people who do the work want to know about and being able to take that research into action. But Karen has done way more than that. You could ask her about what she did to get women firefighters, we were talking about last night. You could ask her about the cleaners on French trains. I won't take a train, use a train bathroom in France ever again. You could ask her about what she's done for elementary school teachers and to demonstrate how hard it is to work with little kids on a regular basis. So there's a whole range of work that she has done that has made a huge difference way beyond academic classrooms, and that's why it's such one of the reasons it's such a thrill to have you here. See, do you still like me?
Yeah, I like you a lot, even if you are a liar. No. So I should say to begin with that I'm very much inspired by Pat for a long, long time, and it's okay to say a long, long time. Right? Yeah. And of course, the double ghetto was totally, it awakened me to the fact that men and women didn't do the same jobs, and I'll be talking a little bit about that. So thank you, Pat, and you can go home now.
Okay.
Because she does have to leave pretty soon. Well, I'm delighted to be here, and I'm going to be talking a lot about the university-union agreement that we have at the University of Quebec. And I have an ulterior motive that I'm going to tell you about right away, which is that I really, as long as there's only one of it, we're very, very vulnerable. And there is right now an attack on it after 40 years. So, at my university, and so I'm really onto having other universities develop similar agreements, and the CIUT is getting involved, which is the Canadian Association of University Teachers. They're interested in spreading the word. So I'm just going to start out with that, so you know. So what this? Can you read this? Writing, yes, you. Boy, it's nice to be young. I'm an ergonomist, and ergonomics is the science of work analysis, so that's what I do. And I work a lot on musculoskeletal disorders, and the question is, how would a scientist working on musculoskeletal disorders, why would they ever need to talk to workers? And the question sounds silly to people here, I'm sure, but in fact, there are many, many scientists working on musculoskeletal disorders among workers who have never actually spoken to a worker. So that's what I want to talk about, if I can get this thing to go forward somehow. Maybe it's the other way around. Or maybe
did you
it works
maybe,
with
yes.
this.
I
with don't this.
May I?
Yes, yeah, sure.
Do you want to full screen it?
Oh, that would be a good idea. Okay.
Okay.
And then you think those things will work?
Yeah, we can just
terrific.
Hit the
okay.
one below.
So in 1976, which is a long time ago, it's 40 years this year, the University of Quebec in Montreal and the three major trade union confederations in Quebec signed an agreement that provided that the university would give space, professors' time, and a certain amount of money, so that professors would do research and training that had been requested formally by one or all of the unions. And that eventually became an agreement between, or engendered rather, an agreement between our research center and the unions on a research program in women's occupational health, and I'll get back to that in a minute. And from 1995 to two years from now, we have guaranteed peer-reviewed funding from federal and provincial governments for research on gender, work, and health. So the idea is to show you that we start with questions of workers, and we end up with lots of money. So it's a good idea for universities to do this. Okay. We're going to also discuss whether it's a good idea for the unions. Now, getting back to the Union University Agreement, I got hold of the last annual report, and there were 18 research projects and 8 training projects that were in various stages in 2014. And they were in all kinds of different fields, history, sociology, management. I've got a list of some of them on the next slide. And the university invested $18,000 in all this and got back $66,000 in outside funding. And 29 students were involved in these different projects. And they were making money on them. I mean, all this money went to student salaries. And several have gotten jobs in unions or gotten summer jobs with unions. So that has been an important contributor, certainly to Sam Yo's, but also to other departments. So, for example, here's some projects that I thought would interest you because they're in the area of labor. In occupational health and safety, there's a project judging on how the management of occupational health and safety works in nonprofit daycare centers. Another in the biomechanics of sign language interpretation. So if you're moving your hands around, doing sign language interpretation all day, how does this work for your musculoskeletal disorders in your upper limbs? The determinants and consequences of just-in-time scheduling in a context of work-family balancing, access to legal protection among temporary foreign workers, et cetera. There were two others that I didn't have in the area of labor that I didn't have a chance to put. Don't feel you have to take notes because I'm happy to send this presentation to Mark. So in terms of our own team, the team that worked on women's occupational health, the intent of the union partners, and these union partners were the three women's committees and the three health and safety committees of the three union confederations. They wanted first to fill in gaps in information about women's occupational health, and this slide is the one that shows why that was necessary in 1993, and it's still necessary in 2016, and that is that if you look at the, in the area of cancer, somebody did a study of what research was being produced on occupational health and safety in cancer research, and if you look at who was being studied in 1991 to 1995, 31% of the studies included both men and women. 62% were on men only, and only 7% were on women only. So 9 times more about men, just men, than about just women. These in later years, 2012 or 2006 to 2009, it's only 3 times more studies about just men than just women. So it's getting better, but it's not, we're not there yet. And the same thing is true in the area of solvents and their toxic effects. And I could show you stuff about musculoskeletal disorders as well. So there's a need for understanding about women and occupational health. There's a need for a kind of a feminist lens looking at it, because women are often given the choice between their health and their money. So, for example, if you ask, should women do night work, it's really hard to do work-family balancing with night work, although paradoxically many women take night shifts because they say then their husbands can babysit. But the question is, if you're having to wake up in the morning and make breakfast, or come home in the morning from your night shift and make breakfast, and then you can't get to sleep in the, during the day because you're doing work-family stuff, is this unfair, or should you be excused from night shifts under conditions where your male colleagues are doing them? So there's that kind of question about does equality require you to sacrifice your health? Similarly, should women lift the same heavy weights as men? Should they lift them differently? Should women's biology receive specific attention? Should pregnant women be excused from some tasks? Should people who are exposed to severe cold and get menstrual cramps have special consideration? Chemical exposures are metabolized differently in different hormonal environments. Should we talk about this, or is it scary to talk about this because women may lose their jobs under certain circumstances, et cetera? So the whole that whole set of questions was being asked. And finally, the thing that we've done a lot of work on is the question of whether the risks that women are exposed to are real risks. That is, if you want to think about a dangerous job, people tend to think about a man working on a scaffolding and being about to fall off the scaffolding because it looks dangerous, it's scary, it makes you want to pee in your pants. Men get scared too. Or you think of a man with his big bulgy muscles bulging and lifting up an extraordinarily heavy weight. And for some reason, our culture thinks it's okay for men to do this. It doesn't think it's okay for women to do this, and therefore the risks that women are exposed to are usually risks that are much less visible and scary looking. And the question is, are they risky? And when we started, Catherine LaPelle, who is a legal analyst, did a whole series of studies showing that in circumstances where people were looking for workers' compensation for stress or for musculoskeletal disorders, there was definite prejudice against women's jobs, and women were very much disadvantaged in this kind of adversarial situation where their claims were specifically refused. We were asked, therefore, to show that it was dangerous for women to do repetitive weight lifting, even when the weights were really small. And one of the invisible hazards, to quote Andrew's thesis, that women are exposed to is prolonged static standing. So if you look at a grocery supermarket cashier in Ontario or Quebec, or in fact North America, you'll notice that they work standing. And this is not true in Europe, it's not true in Africa, it's not true in Asia, not true in Latin America, but it is true in North America and to some extent in Australia. So, and that's a picture of a woman standing all day. And so the question is this a real risk for health? And Quebec law requires employers to provide a seat if a job can be done in a seated position. And in 1989, one of my colleagues, Nicole Vecina, who was an ergonomist, was asked to study the job of supermarket checkout clerk. Because this clerk was asking for the Occupational Health and Safety Authorities to require that she be given a seat because she had a backache. And so Nicole was interested in this job, and she had done her master's and PhD in the context of the worker university agreement. So they knew her, and they asked her to examine this job. And she went to court with her then newborn baby in her arms and testified that, yes, the job could be done sitting down, which was kind of ridiculous because it's done sitting down everywhere else but here. And the supermarket clerk won her case. So this might be a nice example of how the protocol, the agreement between the unions and the universities, is useful to workers, except that last summer I went down and photographed the cashier at my local supermarket, and here she is, and you'll notice that she's standing. And so are all the other supermarket cashiers in Quebec. So the question is, should she be standing, and why is she still standing? And so what I'm going to be talking about from here on is, what have we learned from workers about standing and sitting? What have we learned about research? What have we learned about social class bias in research? And why are cashiers still standing? So the first thing about prolonged standing is that many scientists think this is a really good thing. So here's a 2012 in the Archives of Environmental and Occupational Health, which is a learned journal, peer-reviewed. And their headline, the editorial headline, is Reducing Sitting Time, the New Workplace Health Priority. So here's a bunch of epidemiologists saying that sitting is really bad for you. And the workers are reading this, right? I mean, it's not like they don't know about this, and the employers are reading this. And then I go to my ergonomics magazine, which is called Ergonomics Canada, and I look at this ad. And this ad, which is in French, and it says, Des solutions flexibles pour le poste de travail ergonomique. Okay? Flexible solutions for an ergonomic work posture. And you look at this woman, can you see her shoes? And I don't know if you can, but they're these big heels, this big, and she's supposed to stand in these heels all day at this workstation. And not only that, she's supposed to be working with her arms like this. This is an ergonomic working posture. So this is what ergonomists are being told. And they're going into workplaces and working on them with that idea. And here's an expression that you may have heard, which is sitting is the new smoking, okay? Like we all know that tobacco is very, very, very bad for us, and we shouldn't smoke. Well, the same thing is true of sitting. Shouldn't sit because it's the new smoking. So this is one of the things that's happening that's leading to the fact that, to some extent, workers, but particularly employers, think that it's not a serious problem if people stand. So what is the evidence? That was just in case you hadn't seen the shoes. Well, what is standing at work? Okay, and I used to have a picture of the Montreal Canadiens on the ice working, because they're professional workers, right? And they stand all day at work. And that's a standing posture. Given the season that they've been having, I took their picture off, but this is different things that are all called standing, right? Standing isn't just one thing. Standing is, you can be crouched, you can be lean over, you can be like this elementary school teacher who works all day like this because she's going from desk to desk. Or you can be standing like a cashier, you can be stretching. And so if you're standing at work and you're answering a questionnaire by an epidemiologist and they say, do you stand at work, which is what most of these questionnaires say, you could be talking about any number of postures. And in particular, they don't assess whether you're standing still or whether you're walking. And if you think about it from a physiological point of view, standing still and walking are very, very different things for your physiology, and particularly for your circulatory system, okay? If I stand like this for a long time, the blood is gonna end up down here, and my legs are gonna swell, and my blood pressure on the top of my body is going to drop, and the blood pressure on the bottom of my body is going to go up. And a lot of other things are going to happen because I have regulatory things in my body that try to compensate for these things. If I'm walking and moving, then different things are happening. My circulation is different, but also my musculoskeletal exertion is different. The pressure on my joints gets relieved from time to time, etc. And if you listen to the supermarket cashiers, the first thing they tell you is, I really enjoy being at position one much more than the other positions. What's position one? I don't know how it works here, but in Quebec, there's the position where you come into the store and it's bigger than the other positions. So they're selling cigarettes, they're taking in old bottles. It's the one where you get to move around more. And they all say, the more I move around, the better it is. So the workers know this. They tell us. But of course, the scientists don't know it yet. Because there's the question on the questionnaire says, do you stand? So we did a study with some epidemiologists from the Institute, from the National Institute of Public Health in Quebec. First thing is, a lot of people have musculoskeletal disorders. 25% of women workers, 16% of men workers report work-related musculoskeletal disorders with persistent disabling pain. That is, pain that you have felt always or most of the time for the last year and that has prevented you from doing your usual activities. So if we look at specifically foot pain and lower limb pain, and we look at, and we compare sitting to standing, we can see that people have much more pain when they stand than when they sit, both men and women, both in the feet and in the lower limbs. Lower limbs is this area. We have them crossing it off on a picture. But the other thing that you notice when you do the comparisons is that the women have more pain than the men. So women who stand have more pain than men who stand, and both in their lower limbs and in their feet. So the question is, why do women have more pain? And people will immediately think, well, women complain more, women are not as strong, and so forth. So we wanted to understand the answer to that. So one of the things we did was we looked at the position, the actual position. We were enabled to do this because we had been involved in writing the questions for this national questionnaire that was circulated in Quebec. And the reason we were able to get the question into the questionnaire, because it is not easy to get questions into a questionnaire. They cost money. Each question costs a lot of money, and you have to argue. And we had to go up to a deputy minister in order to get the question on the different working postures onto the questionnaire. And we've never been able to do it since. So this is a one-time opportunity to look at the specifics of standing postures. And we consulted workers, and we found out that these were the important categories. So do you work in a fixed standing position? Do you move a little bit? And we gave definitions in a small area. Do you move a lot, from one assembly line to another? Or is it variable? Can you vary your posture? And there was a male-female difference where in the more fixed positions, there were more women. In the more variable positions, there were more, relatively more men. And this was significant at 0.001, yeah, something like that. And so then we thought, well, is the pain difference attributable to this difference in the working postures? And what do you know? Yes, women who stand in a fixed position have much more pain than women who sit, but especially women who sit but are free to stand at work. And for men, it's 3.5, so that's not different.
Just wondering, was it the same occupation?
No, this is across.
Just across the...
All occupations. Yeah. You just can't get an N big enough if you... enough people to do it within an occupation.
Have got enough for a study.
Yeah. What we've done is we've done studies within a particular factory, so where we've correlated the amount of pain with the amount of moving around, and we've corroborated this. And I'll get back to that in a minute if you like. But this was a questionnaire-based, population-based study, and Similarly, men who stand in a fixed position have 1.7 times more pain than men or women who stand and are free to sit. So the freedom to sit becomes an important variable. And when we did it, do it on a factory level, the one time that we were able to do it, because you need employer consent. Not very many employers are going to let you come in and watch employees all day and see whether they sit or stand. And in fact, this employer, somebody wanted to do a TV study, a TV program on what we had found out, and they were regretting that they ever let us into the factory. They wouldn't let anybody come in and film. But what we did was a student master's degree project was to watch these workers all day and see exactly how much time they really did sit and stand. And when you do that, the more they move around, the less pain they have. And this was at a level where people were spending between 5 and 15% of their time moving. They weren't moving very much. So even a little bit of moving was good. So what we conclude from this is that both men and women who can't control their working posture have more pain, but among men and women, fewer women than men can control their posture. Therefore, more women have pain related to their standing posture. So why would this be true? And this gets back to your question, because over a population, men and women have different jobs. I put this retail sales job in color because it's the only one of the top 10 men's and women's jobs that are the same. And in fact, if you go up to 25 jobs, even the latest results that have just come out for good back, there are 3 jobs that are in common between the men and women in the first 25. So men and women really don't work in the same places, as Pat Armstrong told us in 1990. But different professions are only part of the story. If you look at the same job being done by women and men, we looked at hospital cleaners in the same hospital, and women on the average spent 38 minutes a day cleaning toilets in this posture, and men spent half that time. Nobody will be surprised. And on the other hand, when it was mopping, which you kind of go down the hospital corridor mopping, men spent twice the amount of time as women. So, and this was not something we had anticipated. This was something that one of the students went and wrote down all our observations and then analyzed afterwards. I don't think you could say that we were prejudiced about it because we wouldn't have predicted it. And we've done another study in restaurants, and again, there are great differences between ways women and men do their jobs. So when we think that men and women do a million things at work differently, that makes us wonder about how does science treat gender in large-scale population analyses. And what usually is done is they adjust the effect, the responses for gender. So if you're studying the relationship between solvent exposure and cancer, and you see that there is a difference between the numbers of cancers of women and men, you're going to adjust the analysis by adding a number of cancers to one group and that you don't add to the other group. You try to make everything mathematically similar, okay? Or if you see that one group is exposed to more of a risk than the other group, you'll adjust it so it looks like they're both being exposed to the same risk so that you can isolate the effect of the risk from the effect of gender, okay? So what happens when you do this mathematical procedure, but the risk is different, but you haven't been able to measure that difference? And that's the example we have. We have the example where it looks like both men and women are exposed to standing, but women have more pain than men. So normally, when you adjust an analysis, you You would add a little bit of paint onto the men to make them look like the women, and then you would do the rest of your analysis to see what was causing the differences in the musculoskeletal disorders. But when you haven't measured how much they're moving, when you have a big unmeasured factor that's differentiating men and women, what you're doing is you're making the unmeasured risk disappear, and you're not able to find out about it. So luckily for us, we had the workers to tell us, wait a minute, I feel worse in position one. But if you don't have the workers to tell you this, if you're not in the workplace, you don't speak to the workers, you're working only with numbers, then you don't know that. And so you're doing a mathematical procedure that is not only generally done, but it is even a criterion for good studies that's used by people like the Cochrane Collection, so forth. If you don't adjust your studies for gender, you're doing a bad study, and you're left out of all the meta-analyses that are done. So we got very involved in, so this procedure makes the difference between standing and moving invisible, and so the workers' questions and interests have taken us from examining working postures to questioning standard procedures and data analyses. And we've been involved in dialogue with other scientists about this now for, it's got to be almost 20 years. And this is only one example of things that we have been arguing about that come from our contact with workers and put us in a critical position with regard to standard scientific practice. And I could go into in molecular biology when we were first doing studies of cells being exposed to radiation. Again, we were doing studies in a way that nobody else was doing them. They're doing them now, 40 years later, but they weren't doing them then. And we used to get into terrible fights because they weren't looking at the test from the workers' point of view. So I think that looking at what workers' questions are has been good for science. The question is, has it been helpful to workers? So let's get back to standing at work. Is standing at work a health risk? Well, what does the literature say? Well, I'm quoting particularly our buddies who are aware of the fact that you need to distinguish between standing and moving. And there's a certain amount of research that says that if you stand all day, you'll get varicose veins, you'll get carotid atherosclerosis, which is hardening of the arteries in your carotid artery. You'll get orthostatic intolerance, which is getting this disease, which is you're sitting down, you stand up, and you get dizzy, and you fall over. And you have increased mortality. And in terms of work-related musculoskeletal disorders, you get back problems, lower limb problems, and muscle fatigue. Well, what happens if you sit all day? Is prolonged sitting a health risk? And some of the evidence says that you'll have increased mortality, you'll have increased diabetes, and you'll have increased circulatory problems if you sit all day, and you'll also have back problems. So it's got to be some kind of mix of standing and sitting. So then all the journalists call me up and they say, okay, how much time of the day should I be standing and should I be sitting? And that's the kind of question an ergonomist hates because we don't know. The study that I told you about where we were walking around in factories, we found that 7% of the time sitting was enough to make people have much less pain. There's a master's thesis, a PhD thesis that somebody did a couple years ago that said 20 minutes, but he had just picked that out of a hat. 20 minutes was actually the time that he chose to expose his workers to sitting and standing, and then he turns around and says, so 20 minutes is the right time, but he has no idea because he never tried any longer. Less than 3/4 of the time, that was the result of one study. Is it different for everybody? I think that people would sort of intuitively think that it would be different for a big fat person than for a little tiny person. It would be different for an active person than an inactive person and so forth. And I think that the common sense, and certainly what workers tell us, is that what's really nice is if you feel like sitting down, you should sit down. And if you want to stand up, you should stand up. And all you need to do is engineer your workstation, which can easily be done in the case of cashiers, so that sometimes you're sitting and sometimes you're standing and you get to decide when that is. And the problem is that what workers tell us is that if they survive the first month of a prolonged standing job, the way they survive is by becoming insensitized to the signals that their bodies are sending them. Okay, if you are still aware that your legs are hurting after a month on the job, you just can't stand doing that job. So you haven't lasted at the job and you're out of the job. But most people have a way of just disconnecting. And when you do that, if you've been standing all day and somebody offers you a seat, you don't even want to sit down. Because if you sit down, all of a sudden it's going to come rushing in. And you're going to become aware, whoops, I was hurting, and I know I don't want to stand up again. So that what you need is a work site where you can follow your instincts when they first come to you, and you can sit as you need to and stand as you need to, which, if you think about it, is human, right? I mean, there's no reason why people should have to stand all day. And but most studies of sitting and standing don't assess your freedom to sit or stand at will. In fact, I've never seen, except for on our questionnaire, I've never seen a question that asked, can you sit or stand at will? And yet, in our questionnaire, it was the single variable that was the most important determinant of back pain, leg pain, and foot pain. So, what do we know about posture? Standing is a risk. Immobility is a risk. Some mix of moving and rest is advisable. Workers can perceive their own symptoms and regulate their own posture, and therefore being able to control their posture would be helpful. But working posture in Quebec today, almost half of all workers stand more than three quarters of the time at their job, and more than one worker in six, 18-17% of workers stand in a fixed position all day. So, why are cashiers still standing? We asked them. Number one, who stands without access to seats? People who are younger, people who are poorer, people who are manual workers, particularly female manual workers, but also 69% of male manual workers. And a good third of manual workers can't sit whenever they need to. What jobs are we talking about? Waitresses among women, waitress or barmaids, saleswomen, cashiers, cleaners, nurses' aides, and cooks make up 65% of the population who stand and have pain every day. So why can't they sit? We interviewed 30 workers, and they said things like employers would think I was lazy, and that's because every so often, for example, one of our interviewees worked in a gas station. Her employer had come in a few months before and just taken all the seats out of the, one of those little, my English is eluding me, but one of those little stores that they have at gas stations. They took all the seats out because they said that they wanted people to be alert for the customers. It's impossible to sit at my job. A lot of cashiers say it's impossible to sit at my job because they haven't read any college study and they haven't been to Europe. But of course it is, but it would require a little bit of money to redesign the workstation so that they could sit. If I were to sit, I would find it hard to get up again. That's what I was talking about a few minutes ago. I didn't make it up, I heard it from them. And there are a number of excuses that are given for why people can't sit, and people, it's rare that people will do a strike, for example, on the issue of sitting. Why aren't they insisting on seats? Partly because each person has their own strategy of avoiding foot pain. We're in banks watching bank tellers, and some of them have put little piles of telephone books under the seat so they can put one foot up. They have special shoes. They pay money for a mustache. They pay money for special stockings. I don't know if you remember the bank teller I showed in the very, very beginning. I meant to point it out to you. She's leaning like this on her. I was observing her, and she was about my age at that time. I was a little child of 53, and she was doing this, and she was doing this, and she and I had a little talk about back pain, and it only took about 20 minutes before I was having back pain as well, just standing and watching her. And the manager came over and gave me a seat and said, "Here, you must be tired." And I didn't want to get her in trouble, so I didn't say anything. But it was obvious that if I was, you know, after a half an hour feeling back pain and leg pain, she really needed a seat a lot more than me. And as the day went on, she was spending more and more time in this position, taking the weight off her feet, off her back, and onto her arms. So postures, hiding. Oh, yeah, that was one woman in a store had hid behind the columns in the store. She had figured out that the manager was watching from a window on the second floor, and so she found this column that was right between her and the manager, and she'd sit in the back of the column. Smoking is a really good strategy if you want to be able to take a break in places that don't give you breaks. By the way, this is illegal, but it is a very widespread practice, at least in Quebec, to not let people take their breaks. And the only people who get to take breaks under these circumstances are smokers, because everybody knows, like managers know, that smokers really need their cigarette. Like, they don't really need to stand, despite the fact that sitting is the new smoking. They don't really need to sit in the same way. So, and then this desensitization that I was talking about, where people become unaware of what their body is telling them, which is a pretty dangerous thing when you're thinking about health protection. Why aren't they insisting on seats? Because for anybody who's working in a store, and we've done another study since then, the most important thing about working in a store, and probably some of you have done this, is getting hours. If you can't get hours, if you can't get enough work hours, you're not going to make any money. And any other problem is secondary to that. Getting the right work schedule, a schedule that you, if you're a student, a schedule that's compatible with your classes. If you're not a student and you have a family, getting home for dinner time, not working at 9 o'clock on Sunday morning. These are very important to you, and they are important in an immediate sense and not in a long-term health protecting sense. And people tend to very naturally want to survive economically and be able to be home with their families before they're going to think about, am I going to have really severe back problems when I'm 40 or 45? And they want to get paid, and that's kind of important, because if you complain at work and you make trouble, you may end up getting fired, and so that's not a good idea either. And then getting access to work breaks. That's if people are going to struggle for something, they're going to struggle for being allowed to have their breaks. And now that we have these computer programs that set up when breaks are, I don't know if you know about this, but the way that work hours are determined in a whole bunch of different jobs now is they take all the work volume statistics are. Like in a store, it would be the cash register receipts. And you plot them by hour. And then you spit those, and you put those into a machine, and the machine spits out the work schedules. And it will often spit out, you start work at, say, 8 o'clock, and your first break is at 9 o'clock, and your lunchtime is at 2 o'clock. I mean, it's not anything physiological that it spits out necessarily. So people spend time on getting access to work breaks. And so we do need to intervene. But the problem is that these, and I've been meeting them, all these ergonomists and scientists who think that sitting is the new smoking, and that everybody should be out jogging the way they are, and people should be active at work. And it's because the standpoint of scientists when we do our jobs is our own standpoint. It's what we know. It's our own experience. And if we haven't had a university union agreement to put us in contact with workers, that means that we think about people doing desk jobs who are free to get up and walk around whenever they want. And we have a lot of job autonomy, and we don't understand. I mean, one of my colleagues said, I said, here's this woman, and she has this terrible job, and he said, well, she should get another job, you know. And it was just so clear that he had no idea what this black, older woman with two parents to support and for whom she had to take care of all their medical procedures and all their, and she had to take them to all their doctor's appointments and everything like that. So she had to have free time in her schedule. On the other hand, she had to support them economically, so she had to maximize her hours of working. And she was caught in this complete trap of having to work more and having to work less at the same time. And he had no idea of what she was dealing with because he'd never talked to her. And so it's not his fault. I mean, he wasn't any dumber than any other scientist, but it was just a gap. And so what I think is that it's really important to have partnerships with low-income workers because we learn as scientists about the determinants of discomfort and disease. This pointed to new research questions. It enabled us to understand our research results, and I could tell you some more anecdotes about that, and made us aware of, in the case of women, how difficult it is to argue at the same time that women should be given what the employers think of as special treatment when they're very, very low-valued workers. And so it's the battle between equality and health that it has become much more salient to us as the years have gone on and as we've contacted more workers. So solutions. Well, I mean, I'm pleading, as I say, for more contact between scientists and workers and more understanding and more dialogue and more exchange so that we have a policy of giving our results to the workers and having them comment on them before we do anything else with those results. And it's a procedure that makes us learn a tremendous amount. And we can actually, despite all the pessimism of what I've been telling you, there are very specific instances where we have been able to come to joint solutions and where the unions have been extremely happy, both with the solutions that we suggest, but also with the fact that through us and through our dialogue with the workers, the union hierarchy also are made aware of what their own workers are saying. This is rare, and I really, really would like to see our agreement generalized to other universities before they take it away from us. Thank you. And that's a book I wrote about what we learned from workers. And yeah. That's what I wanted to say.
All right. Thanks very much. I was perfect timing.
I was watching my watch.
Okay, I'm going to, we have time for some discussion at Q&A.